That's right.
Of course. Ah, of course. Voilà. Merci pour ça. Ça fait.
Okay, let's get started. Okay.
Hello, everybody. Hello, and welcome to our discussion. This year, the English language selection of the festival is Becoming Liz Taylor by Elizabeth Dillo. We are very pleased to have Elizabeth with us today. And to begin with, Elizabeth will read us an excerpt from her book, and then I will ask a couple of questions to warm us up a little bit in the discussion, and then we'll open it up to the audience for more questions. Okay, so I will pass it to Elizabeth.
Okay, thank you. It's lovely to see you all here. Thank you so much for coming. I'm going to read a little bit at the beginning. This is called, writers call this the inciting incident. So in a story, you need to have, you know, you set the scene, you set the tone, you show the characters' everyday life, and then there's something happens that throws everything into chaos. It's sort of the catalyst for the rest of the story. So this is the inciting incident of Becoming Liz Taylor, and it is the part where I think many of you have read it. So it's an older woman who dresses as Elizabeth Taylor, who steals a baby. So she goes to, she's living in Weston-super-Mare, a town on the coast of Somerset in the UK, and she has gone to the hairdresser, and she is going to go for a walk along the seafront in a moment. Val was pleased with her hair. The firm set meant the rolls would keep their volume, and the colour was just what she'd asked for. She'd gone a bit darker. Cleopatra Black, she'd described it to the hairdresser. As she left the salon, she took another glance in the mirror. When she stepped out onto the pavement, she imagined a line of flashbulbs, and she smiled, held her head to one side and then the other, her neck extended. With its millefeuille layers of lace petticoat, she loved how her dress moved forward and back as she walked off towards the seafront, like a bride walking up the aisle. It was colder along the front. The wind came in sudden gusts from the Bristol Channel, the cries of seagulls, hysterical or mournful, depending which way the wind caught them. Val watched a gull flap across the sand and settle on the low wall between the pavement and the beach. The tide was out, the sea somewhere out there across the flats. So far away, it was hard to imagine it was there at all. The sand was the colour of rain. Lights on the Grand Pier flashed dismally, but there wouldn't have been many pleasure seekers today. The bright red of the helter-skelter at the end of the pier stood out against the grey sky. The roller coaster was still. A tourist train trundled along the promenade, carrying a few local people to save the long walk from town. Up ahead on beach lawns, next to the ugly sprawl of pirate adventureland, the Western Eye, an observation wheel carrying 30 caged viewing pods, revolved slowly. It was a recent addition to the seafront, promising spectacular views over the whole sweep of the bay. On the pavement underneath the wheel, Val felt its heavy rotation and heard its mechanical whine, its clicks and creaks. A pram was parked next to the ticket kiosk at the foot of the wheel. It was angled so that Val was able to look in as she approached. The baby was asleep, its head to the side, its tiny mittened fists up by its ears. The yellow waffle blanket with its wide satin hem was identical to the one she'd had for Duncan. It took her right back. Val looked around. The baby appeared to be all on its own. There was a man in the ticket kiosk talking on his phone, his back to the window. There was no sign of a mother, no sign of anyone. If Val had looked up, she might have noticed that one of the wheel's pods was occupied. If she'd listened, she might have heard the giggles of a child above her head, the sing-song wee of a woman. Val didn't think about it. She didn't even break her stride. She kicked the brake off the pram and pushed it as if she did it every day. her palms wrapped around the contours of the handle, fitted into the grooves in the blue plastic as if it were made for her hands. She picked up pace, walked faster than she had for 30 years. Her heart thudded, left, right, the swift rhythm of her steps like an organist pedals. She passed the amusement arcade, all its electronic noise hanging in the doorway. Left, right, faster. A man in a leather bomber jacket hurried past with his head down, a tabloid rag under his arm. The baby slept. Val's fingers gripped tighter. She looked through the handle of the pram and saw her feet walking and walking. She felt her heartbeat. She felt her pulse in her arms. She glanced behind her. The big wheel was far away now. The pavement was empty, save for an old couple in bobble hats, sitting on a bench, staring out to sea.
Thank you for that extract. So I will begin with a couple of questions, and then I will open it up to the audience. To begin with, this novel takes place in several seaside towns, such as Weston-super-Mare, Aberdovey in Wales, and Brighton. Mm-hmm. And there are these wonderfully evocative descriptions of this environment, the piers, the promenade, the seafront, the amusement arcades. We practically feel that we're there. We can hear the cry of the seagulls. We can feel the breeze off the water. So my questions, three questions related. Why did you choose seaside towns as the backdrop for your novel? And what does the seaside evoke for you personally? And how does it inspire you as a writer?
Okay, that's quite a lot there to answer. okay, so why seaside towns? I think the setting for came first, and it was because I'll tell you the story of what inspired the novel, which gave me the first setting. So the reason why I wrote the book at all came from a snippet of dialogue I once heard. I heard when I was standing in a queue, so I was in Weston-super-Mare, where Val lives and where the novel is set. And I went to see the street artist Banksy. There's an old Lido, an old swimming pool in Weston-super-Mare, which I didn't grow. I grew up not far from there when I was a child, and I remember going to the Lido when it was open, you know, back in the 1970s. So it sort of already had a bit of a tie to me. But I went back to Weston-super-Mare, and I went to see this art exhibition, and I was standing in a queue, waiting to go in. And they say that writers need to listen and observe and eavesdrop and steal things. And by this point I was writing. I sort of considered myself a bit of a writer, although I wasn't published or anything. So I overheard two women talking, and one of them said to the other, "Have you seen that woman who walks around Weston-super-Mare dressed as Elizabeth Taylor?" And I thought, I just heard that. I didn't hear anything else. I just heard that one line of dialogue. And I just thought, wow, that's really interesting. Why would somebody do that? You know, what is it about her? Is it, and to what extent is she dressing as Liz Taylor? You know, is it the full on kind of, fur coat and makeup, or is it just a nod or whatever? So I went home that evening, and I wrote it into a notebook, and it sat there for 5 years. And I came back to it when I had the idea for this, and I started doing a master's degree in creative writing. So I already had the idea. So I suppose the story came from a true person, an actual person who lives or was living at the time. And because it's somebody who walked around Weston-super-Mare, then there was my setting. But then I took that was a good setting for her, because then I envisaged, like, who would this character be? You know, and I started building her story and building her backstory. And I thought, well, she's 72 years old, that's what I arrived at. And she's got this kind of tired, sad past, you know. And Weston-super-Mare is quite an old-fashioned place. You know, it's one of those very run-down seaside towns that used to be, it had its heyday in the 50s and the 60s, but is now pretty old-fashioned, you know.
And
kind of exactly. So I thought that ties in with Val. It ties in a bit with Liz Taylor. And then I had her son, Rafe, who I just thought it would be quite interesting to have two very contrasting seaside towns. So Rafe lives in Brighton, which of course is the opposite of that. You know, it's loud, it's kind of, you know, trendy, it's kind of, you know, it's happening, it's very now. And I thought it would be quite interesting to have two very different characters living in those two different places. Plus, you know, I know Weston-super-Mare. I lived in Brighton for a short time in the 1990s. So I know those two places. And then when Val runs away with the baby, she goes to North Wales. And that is a place that I have visited once, but it really struck me how beautiful and how remote it was. And I thought that if Val is going to run away anywhere, that is where she'd take the baby. And again, that offered another, a different seaside town. So yeah, I just thought I liked the symmetry of having three seaside places, and just to have them all different, very, very far apart, but they were all sort of part of Val's journey. So yeah, but the seaside for me, I love the seaside, but I think that, you know, so and particularly Weston that I knew well and Brighton that where I lived, it's, you know, I have, you know, friends in Brighton, I know those two places, so it's easy as a writer to use what you know as well.
And you're attached to that environment.
Exactly, yes. Okay. Yeah.
So, well, you mentioned this conversation you overheard. What sparked your interest in this particular story? What was there something in this idea of her dressing up as Liz Taylor that really inspired you? And how did you go about writing a novel with such as this small starting point?
Yeah.
How did you build a novel from that?
I think that's probably what most writers do. They just have one single idea, one single thing, you know, and it often comes from just one character or one, you know, one event or, you know, but I couldn't listen to that line of dialogue and not do something with it. I was so intrigued by this woman who I've still never met and hope I never do, and I don't know who she is or was. But I was just curious, and I started, as I say, I started to build the story around that. And the more I thought about it, and the more I kind of worked out the plot and worked out why she would dress as Elizabeth Taylor, you know, then I came up with, well, she's hurting, you know, and the idea that, well, why would she do that is because the very first conversation she has with her husband, Len, is that he tells her that she looks like Elizabeth Taylor because, you know, she has the violet eyes, which Liz Taylor is famous for. So, yeah, and the story kind of developed from there, you know, and I just sort of built on it and built on it. And then I thought, okay, she was hurting. She's lost a baby. There we go. There's my plot. She's going to steal the baby, you know, so.
So I'll ask one more question and then we'll open it up. So everyone prepare your questions. Okay, you have one more question to think about it. So my next question is, well, the elephant in the room, of course, Elizabeth Taylor. We have to talk about her, right? So she is in the novel's title. There are many references to Elizabeth Taylor throughout the book as a movie star and also in her personal life, right? And the main character, Val, is really intrinsically connected to her. So many things, her wedding dress, so many things are tied back to Elizabeth Taylor, and she was herself, Elizabeth Taylor, a very multifaceted person. We're talking about this earlier. She was sort of larger than life. She was one of those people that took up all the space. She was so amazing, and she herself changed so dramatically over her lifetime, and I thought you said it very insightfully in your book, where you said that she went from a glamorous movie star to a garish presence on the chat show circuit. So I thought that was a very wonderful transition. She went from glamorous to garish. And so my question is, what does Elizabeth Taylor represent to you? Because she can represent so many things. Glamour, she can represent sort of decay. What does she represent to you?
She was the first real celebrity, I think, wasn't she? You know, of her day, you know, in the 50s and 60s. Now, if we had all those celebrity magazines, I'm guessing she'd be on the front page of every one, you know. I wasn't necessarily that interested in Elizabeth Taylor. I love old movies. I love cinema and I love old films. But I probably didn't know her movies particularly. I was never a fan, really. And I think that my interest in her came from that line of dialogue, and I wrote the story. And then I thought, well, now I've got to find out everything. I absolutely love the research of writing. It takes me hours and hours and hours. If we think about the research that I did for this book and just all the places and all the old movies and Elizabeth Taylor particularly. So, when I wanted to write about her and use her, I watched all her movies, I read her, biographies, I sort of, find out more and more and more about her life. And I think that I've never really been particularly interested, but I've become quite a fan, of her because, she's very dear to me now, but I think in terms of what she represents, she is. There's a parallel. A sort of parallel with Val in that she had her day. She was this, gorgeous, really happy, and she did get successful and she did become, a little bit garish and sad. I mean, I think she was happy later on in her life, but, she made some bad choices and I think that, there's a mirroring maybe of Val in a sort of, the decline and I think as well, the garishness that you mentioned when she, was just, churning out the chat show after chat show and she'd be, it was the 80s when she was doing all those chat shows, the era that taste forgot really. And, so she would look garish. But I thought that's why in the story when Val becomes Liz Taylor, she goes for that version, so when she dresses up in the hotel, I won't do too many spoilers, but when she's in Abu Dhabi and she sort of exposes herself in the worst possible way, I just thought she's I wanted to show her really garish,
I like the part where you mentioned that Elizabeth Taylor at one point even apologizes to her audience for growing old.
Yeah.
She says, I'm sorry that I'm growing old.
Yeah, so absolutely. Right. So there's weaving through this, there's the regret of old age that Val has, that Liz Taylor has. Yeah, and that quote perfectly summed it up. So I was really happy to find that quote, because at the beginning in chapter one, Val is looking at herself and just, trying to get rid of the lines on her face and, having to dye her hair because it's going great. And, Cleopatra Black. Yeah. So, it's a story of regret of time passing and lost time, I think. And age is all tied up to that. So the protagonist had to be 72 years old. I just wanted her to be over 70, the sort of older woman.
Okay. We'll open it up to the audience. Is there a question from the audience? We have a special.
Nice to see you.
You too. Thank
okay.
You.
So Val, she stole a child. It's a crime and it's something difficult to forgive.
Yep.
But you manage to make us having sympathy for her.
Yeah.
And maybe she deserves our sympathy. But as far as I am concerned, I have a lot of sympathy and compassion for Ralph.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because, she spoiled his life. And it's very difficult for him to have a stability, to have relation. And, I think his mother was selfish. And Ralph is my favorite character.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. And you're not the first person I've met, actually, in Shonberry since I've been here that say that. And when I've talked about the book before up until now, it's always, I don't think I've come across anyone who blames Val or who doesn't like Val or, who thinks she's, a wicked person. But I can see your point of view. And I'm glad that you love Rafe, because I do too, you know, and he hasn't done anything wrong, you know, in a way that Val has. So I'm really glad that Rafe is coming out as a good guy and as a really sympathetic character, because I ideally, you know, think the world of him, and I think that he, like you say, he's a victim of his mother, of many, many things, actually. He's a victim of his own insecurity, of his own jealousy, and, you know, of long-term grief as well. Plus, you know, poor Rafe having his mother walking around dressed as, you know, in a fur coat and tiara, cooking his dinner, you know, that would plus, you know, that would have been hard to deal with when you're a teenager, you know. Plus, you know, growing up gay in Western Supermare in the 1980s, that would have been tough, you know, just in terms of, you know, a small seaside town. So I think poor Rafe has had a lot to deal with, but and he had his moment of being so successful with Jim and had such a happy life, and poor him has really. But to go back to Val, actually, the character of Val, and I hope you like her a little bit, and you you know, but it was really difficult. It was such a fine line. It was such a tightrope to walk, because I wanted readers to be sympathetic to her, and I wanted her to chime with readers. And I wanted them to understand her motivations for taking the child. And it was, I really had to, so I had to show the backstory. And I really hoped they, not to forgive her or to, you know, she has done the most horrendous, terrible crime. And she rightly should be and will be punished for it. But I was hoping that through the book, readers would at least understand why, you know, to really show that backstory and to show that she's not only has she got a sad story, but she's actually deluded. She lives in a fantasy world, so she's this sort of, you know, this kind of you know, delusion going on all the time. Even to herself, she's in denial, you know, and she knows. I think she knows on some level that she's done something wrong. That she knows in her heart. But actually, she lives in this strange fantasy where, does she though? You know, how much does she really believe, you know, that she's done something wrong? So it was a very, very hard thing to make Val a sympathetic character, given that she's a terrible, terrible criminal.
I'll ask another question.
Thank you for coming to Chamilly.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I was wondering, you said you did a creative writing course.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what the biggest things you learned from that were, and how they helped you write your novel. What parts of your novel were helped by it?
I think the creative writing master's degree came almost sort of later on in my writing journey, really. I'd started writing back in 2008. I can actually remember the exact moment when I started thinking, I want to write things down, you know. I lost my brother in really awful circumstances back in 2008, and I came on holiday with my family, and I just had to kind of write some stuff down. I hadn't had time to kind of think about it or deal with it, and I went to a bookshop. We were in the south of France, and I just said, oh, I just left my family. I sat under a tree with a glass of Kia, and I went to a bookshop and got a notebook, and I started writing stuff down, and that grew and grew and grew and grew and became a novel that was my first novel, actually. This is the Festival du Premier Roman, but this isn't actually my first novel. I wrote a novel before where I think that I cut my teeth. I learned a lot. I made my mistakes. It was very I wouldn't say self-indulgent, but it was therapy, and it was kind of, you know, there was a lot of autobiographical stuff coming out. So I think that that novel took about 15 years, because I was working, I was teaching full time, and I had three children. So the only times I could write was the weekend and in the school holidays. And so it took a long, long time, but I went on every single course, every class I could do. I kept sort of disappearing off for weekends in London. I'm going to go and do this course, this class. Read, come to loads of events like this, you know, go to literary festivals and listen to writers and read loads, you know, and I think it just, plus, so I took that first novel and I sent it off to a professional editor and said, you know, I wanted somebody to look at it and say, you know, is this any good, you know, I sent it away to this person and I said, oh, you know, is my novel any good, and he sent me it back and he said, it's not even a novel at the moment. So I was like, oh, okay, you know, so serious problems with it, you know. And he said, I love your writing. He could see something in my writing, but he said the structure's all wrong. And he taught me, really, this editor to, you know, just by working with him, I learned so much from him in terms of, you know, honing text, but also how to actually put a novel together, how to build it, how to build the structure. So that was all that, and that was, you know, way before the MA, so that was kind of all in the background, and I think all writers say that, is that, you know, you don't just write a novel, send it to an agent, and then suddenly, bang, you've got a book deal. It's years and years and years of learning, actually, and teaching yourself, and, you know, discipline and all that. So, but the MA, so I started the MA in 2020. I was just, you know, really lucky to have the opportunity to quit my job for a year, and, you know, took a bit of a risk and a bit of a gamble and go off and do the MA. But I think then, so I was probably, you know, I saw myself as a writer by that point. But I think what I got from that is working with incredible writers, you know, there's some, you know, brilliant novelists I worked with. Nathan Filer, who was actually been to the festival before, with his debut novel, and Philip Henscher, who's like a literary giant in the UK, and they were my tutors, and they, you know, they helped me, you know, work on this. So you had to submit parts of your text, and you know, it all gets workshopped. So I had my peers reading it and working on it and making suggestions, and certainly my tutors as well, who are all brilliant writers in their own right. So you sort of hang on their every word and you take every bit of advice that you can get. So then we had, you know, we didn't really work that much on craft, but I think it, you know, we weren't taught, there weren't lectures as such, but we were just workshopping each other's writing, and I think that's how, you know, you learn by doing that. You learn by reading other writers as well, and critiquing their stuff. Sorry, that was a really long answer.
No, very
interesting. Thank
you.
Hello.
Hello, nice to see
how
you.
How came for you the need to introduce homosexuality in your book?
That's a really good question. And it was one that I found difficult, actually. The character of Rafe, I didn't particularly think, oh, I'm going to create a gay character. I just started writing him, and it turned out that he was gay. You know, they sort of, quite often, characters just sort of write themselves. You know, they take you in directions that you're not expecting. So, you know, he... So I created that character, and he just, you know, happened to be gay. I had a lot of angst and a lot of worry about creating a gay character and writing a gay character. There's a lot of nervousness at the moment in publishing about appropriation and what you're allowed to write and whose experiences you're allowed to write. And I was very, very aware of that. And I thought, how dare I, as a white straight woman, write a gay man's experience? How dare I? You know, how do I possibly know? And I think it is a debate at the moment in publishing. And you know, I was very nervous. So I wrote him as he was. And it was afterwards, actually, that my editor, when I got this picked up, she said, are you sure you want to... You know, she was fine with him being gay, but there were... there's a couple of very quite explicit, one particularly quite explicit scene of sexual behaviour that could be construed as clichéd gay male behaviour, and I didn't want it to be that. But I thought that I want to show that it's a façon, is one way that, you know, homosexuality might occasionally can be expressed. You know, some gay men behave in that way, a lot don't, you know. And I was really worried that I was portraying him in a cliched way. However, I just thought, well, that's him. I thought it was important that the way he conducted himself and that behaviour that he did was part of his character and part of the way that he was showing that he was hurting and that he's lonely and that he's desperate. So I thought, you know, in the end, I sort of, you know, the editor said to me, you can leave it in or you can just, you know, be more vague about it. And I thought, actually, it's important to show that because I think it's, you know, it's again, it's a way that the reader can understand his character. But I think if you write about, you know, an experience other than your own, you have to be, as long as I show him to be three-dimensional, the fact that he's homosexual is one façon of his character, is not his whole being, is not, you know, he has many other, it's just he happens to be gay, you know. So I thought that as long as I make him a very three-dimensional, rounded character with fears and, you know, his homosexuality is not his raison d'être, it's just, you know, it's superfluous, you know, it's just an additional thing. And the other thing I'll say about that is, you know, I was nervous. I've got one of my very best friends is a gay man, and I just thought I'm going to ask him to read that, and I was very, you know, I was so nervous about it being cliched, and so I asked him to read it. I said, "Can you just read this and just tell me if this is authentic?" You know, I you know, there's one bit where he goes off in, you know, and they yeah, and I said, I don't know what happens, you know, did you introduce you to each other? I have no idea. So I said, just read it. Tell me if you think that's authentic. And he read it and he just goes, oh my God, how do you know me so well? You know, how do you know that experience? You know, you've absolutely nailed it. This is the insecurity of it. This is the fear of it. This is the desperate, you know, the self-loathing afterwards. And you've absolutely depicted that so well. And when he said that, I just thought, well, if it's good enough for him, then, you know, I'm comfortable with it. But it was a difficult decision, and I have had a lot of anxiety about it. And my editor was saying, oh, you know, you're going to get all the Twitter hate, you know, Twitterati will be after you because you're appropriating something. But at the same time, I went to listen to another writer, actually, a woman called Kate Moss, who's a brilliant, brilliant writer in England. I went to Hay Festival. And I listened to her for this exact same reason. She did a talk on who you are allowed to write about as a fiction writer. And the answer is, if I can't write about somebody else's experience, then all I can write about is a 57-year-old white woman who lives in Somerset. And it's an autobiography. So, you know, there has to be some imagination. I have to be able to think about what it's like to be somebody else. But I think, you know, the answer to your question is it wasn't done lightly, and it was a very considered decision.
So thank you for reading the part in your book. I have not read it, but I look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
I especially liked your comments on choosing the places in this book, so like Wales and Brighton, mm-hmm. and so on. And I have a question for you as an author. Is pardon me if it's not relevant, but it's a question about writing books. It's not related to that story.
No, it's fine.
My question is, what do you think makes a great book? I want to write stories, short stories, maybe not novel because it's a lot.
Yeah.
So yeah, I want to write stories and so on, and I'm looking for ideas, how to make a great character, how to choose a place, how to choose a theme and so on. So in your opinion, what makes a great story? What to choose? What to, I don't know, a theme or what kind of tools or linguistic features and so on?
Yeah, many, many things, actually, many things. Some writers start with a character. I think I do, actually. I come up with a character. I think of a person, and then I build the story around them. Other writers do it another way. You know, they might have a plot, and then they start fitting those characters into the plot. But for me, it's about the character, first of all. What are their hopes? What are their wishes? What are their desires? What are their needs? All stories, you must have your protagonist must need something. They must have to get something. You know, what they want and what they need might be two different things, but they have to have something that they're striving for. So that's sort of top writing tip, really. You know, make them have a desire. In terms of location, is it used either somewhere you know? If you don't know that place, you really need to go there and get the feel of the place. But research, I mean, the internet is extraordinary tool for writers. You know, I Googled so much stuff. You know, all the Elizabeth Taylor stuff, all the, the seaside settings. Even though I knew those places, I still, you know, I go on Google Street, you know, Google Maps. I mean, the journey that Val, she goes on a journey through from where she lives up through Wales and then back down to Brighton. I've done every single inch, centimetre of that journey, not just personally. I've driven it, but I've also did it, on Google Maps, and I kind of, I was describing when she arrives in Abu Dhabi, and what would that look like? And I kind of, dropped my mouse, dropped the guy there, and there's a deciduous wood on that side, but research is so much fun. You can spend too long doing it, so you get no writing done. But also in terms of it, it has to be good quality writing as well. You have to just really, really work on shaping your writing, your own writing, and sharpening up your prose and studying other writers and, read books about, how to write well. There are loads of them out there. How to write a novel, how to structure it, There are plenty of books out there, I'd say, and I've read plenty, and I think there is a lot of help. But also just look at other writers and look at similes and metaphors and the way that they build up, all the techniques that you probably learned at school, about how to write well. Evoking the senses, I think, is just that it's a really immersive way of writing. So that, don't just say what you saw, but what can you hear? What can you smell? What does something taste like? And really try to be real in your descriptions. Because for me, that's always so immersive when you read stuff where you they're using the senses and you just feel like you're there. Yeah. The other thing I would say is discipline and time. You have to be, there's a determination there that you put hours in. Practice. Actually, it's like physical exercise. It's like anything. If you write, you get better. You really do. It's like a discipline. It's like an exercise. And the more you write, you really see that you improve. That's why they say that writers should write every day, because that's a good way to get better. Hello.
Hi. I won't disguise this as a question because you seem rather good at picking up on what somebody says. No, I wanted to say two things. First thing about the title, Becoming Liz Taylor.
Yep.
It wasn't necessarily a title that attracted me personally, but it was... it was just perfect. The way you described how you came upon it, it was the impression I had actually that it wasn't central to the book. Actually, it's not about Liz Taylor, and I was hoping that actually.
Yeah.
But it is justified in the title. I actually thought of how can I. What other title could I have found for the book?
Yeah.
So, well, we just get your feedback on that, please.
Okay, yeah, well, it wasn't called that to begin with. I'd called it something else. I called it Tell Mama All was my kind of working title for it, and that's because that's what she used to say. It's what Val used to say to Rafe when he was growing up. It's a reference from the film Place in the Sun. It's what Elizabeth Taylor says, A Place in the Sun, to Montgomery Clift. And I thought it was quite, you know, and she'd sort of say it to Rafe, you know, tell Mama All in this like really creepy American accent. And I thought the fact that it had the word mama in it was important, because this is about motherhood, really, essentially, the book. So that's what I called it. And my publisher didn't like it, and they wanted to change it. And I think the publishers want something really obvious. You know, they don't want subtleties. They want to sell books, and they want something to leap out, and they want to. So, they came back to me and said, oh, what, you know, we're not happy. So me, my agent, and my publisher, we all sort of threw ideas around. And I think this was my idea I came up with while becoming Elizabeth Taylor, I said, and then they just said that was too long. I like it because it's, you know, it's very in your face. It's very, it's very catchy, and, you know, it's quite striking and unusual. But at the same time, you know, it has got a downside, because there are people who think, you know, there is one, I think it's on Amazon or it's on Goodreads. It's one of those websites where they lead feedback. And someone had given me a 2-star review and said, oh, you know, they were expecting a biography of Liz Taylor. You know, I was like, well, there's nothing about Liz Taylor in it. This book is not about Liz Taylor. And I was thinking, well, it sort of is, but, you know, maybe you should have read the blurb. But, yeah. So but I like it. It's an okay title, but it's commercial choice.
It's probably in your interest too, which is good.
Yeah.
I'll hog the microphone just for another.
Remark.
Picking up on what we said about homosexuality, I'll say something. Don't worry, it's not going to be too politically incorrect. But I think our era needs some political incorrectness. So I'll, as you say, mettre mes pieds dans le plat. Mm-hmm. actually, I was at first rather annoyed by yet another novel where there has to be a homosexual character, because there almost always is now, or and like you said, you made it so three-dimensional, I'm taking your term, that it didn't annoy me at all.
Good.
Afterwards.
Okay.
And you hit it on the nail. I mean, actually, that's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Anybody at the moment? Can I ask a question?
Of course you can, Tori.
Is the book that's on the table in front of you, is it the book you wanted to write? Did your editor insist that you change other things apart from the title?
It is pretty much the book that I wrote, actually. I wrote this for my master's degree, and we had to submit 45,000 words of the script of my manuscript to be, you know, as an assignment. You know, that was my mark, if you like. So I it was so edited, you know. I said yesterday, I think, to the students, I edited this book. It was like my eyes were bleeding. I'd looked at it so many times on the screen, physically hurting my eyes. My eyesight is terrible now, and it's all due to this bloody book. My editor said when she got it, when it arrived, I think it was possibly a bit more polished than some manuscripts for that reason. You know, it had already been through this process of editing. I think different editors ask different things of writers. I was really, really lucky with my editor. She's lovely. And she said she made suggestions. So the first thing that happens when a novel gets bought by a publisher is that you get a letter from the editor, and they say, yeah, blah, 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 this is what I think, you know, a big letter. And then, however, you know, if you wanted to consider these things and perhaps this and perhaps that, and what about this? And she was so good, because she said, in a way that maybe some editors don't do, it's your book. it's your decisions, you know, they're your artistic decisions. I want it to feel like your book, you know. So she was great, you know, and she sort of made all these suggestions and said, it's up to you, you know, if you want to do that, if you want to, you know, think of ways that you can do that. So anyway, she's professional editor. I'm a very, very novice, you know, writer with a debut, and I'm going to listen to every word she said, and I did, and I read her suggestions, and every single one, I think, bar one, there was one that I rejected that I wasn't going to do, but everything else, I read it, and I just thought, yeah, yes, that's good. Yep, I'll do that. Yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that. And as I added them in, there weren't loads, actually, because I think, you know, because it came pretty fully formed. But there were a few things, you know, for example, I'll give you a couple of examples. One is that she said, oh, it seems to me like we need to remind the reader that this is a police, you know, there will be police, you know, you have to kind of occasionally sort of put in the reader's mind, oh, there's going to, you know. So in that case, I think I added, like, she turns on the car radio and there's, you know, she hears the news and she goes into a shop and she sees a security camera. So I just put a couple of extra pieces in there. The other thing she suggested was that she really, Howard was a slightly more minor character. So Howard is the man she meets in Abu Dhabi. He had a slightly more minor role, I think, and she said, I really like Howard. Can you do something more with him? Can you develop him a little bit? And so I did. So I think I gave him a couple more chapters and probably fleshed him out a little bit and his backstory and everything. But everything she suggested, and as I could see, as I started sort of working through her suggestions on my, you know, on my manuscript, I could just see it becoming a better and a better novel. You know, I could just see that she totally knew what she was doing. And, you know, all these little changes I made, they were really exciting to do. Because I was like, oh, yeah, now that works and that ties in with that. So, yeah, it was brilliant to get that.
I have a silly question.
Go ahead.
Okay. There's no such thing. Did you choose this bright and colorful cover?
No, I didn't. No, it's all out of your hands, you know. You have no. People say, "Oh, you know, do you have input into the cover? What do you want the cover to be? You know, can you make suggestions?" And the answer is that you is out of your control completely, and you know, you sort of just. Hope and hope and hope that you'll like it. And it is important, you know, covers are really important and everyone says, oh, you know, what do you want your cover to be? And can you imagine your cover? And I thought, I have no idea what they're going to come up with. But all I wanted to do was like it, you know, because, you know, if I didn't like it, I think then you've got to be that writer that goes, oh, you know, I don't really know, and start being really fussy and precious about your book. But anyway, so they sent me the PDF of this through email, and I got it one afternoon. It just landed in my on my computer, and so I had this PDF, and I was just hovering my finger. I was just like, I can't answer it. I can't open it. I was so nervous because I thought, I don't know what. I have no idea. Anyway, I clicked on it and I took one look at it, and I was like, I love it. I absolutely love it. You know, it's so striking. I mean, I was so happy that they'd gone for Elizabeth Taylor, you know, because at the time we did have the name actually, but the fact that they put her on the cover, it's so obvious. Again, they've gone for the completely commercial, you know, thing, which is fine, but I was really happy that, you know, they went for it, and and it's so colourful. I think it's really striking. I think it's, you know, it's the only thing, thing I made the suggestion, well, there's two things actually. They'd made it a bit blue, a bit too blue, and I said, oh, it needs to be a bit more purpley. And the other thing is that there was no beauty spot. And so I said, oh, you know, I want, can you put the beauty spot on? And they said, oh, well, it might be Val, it might be. I'm like, well, if it is Val, she'd probably have the beauty spot on there. So that's the only thing that I requested that they added, which they did, you know. So,
did just spoke about the character of Howard.
Yeah.
What gave you the idea of introducing a love interest in the story?
That's a good question, actually. I can't remember sort of when that arrived, you know. I suppose I wanted to give a hint of happiness, really. You know, I mean, she's you know, got this love of her life, Len. And I think that, you know, I wanted something to happen when she went to Aberdovey. I didn't want her just to be there with the baby and then not much happened. So I wanted there to be an encounter there that was significant. And then, of course, I just came up with this character of Howard and wanted him to be really a lovely, lovely person, you know. But I think that what that did for her, for them, for their relationship, it presents a potential of a closure for her, you know, after the death of Len and after all these long, long years of grief, that there is a potential there, or there was a fleeting moment of happiness I wanted to create, you know, so that she was, you know, she had this, you know, little episode that was beautiful for both of them and full of promise. Whether anything will happen in the future, whether that will, you know, be continued, who knows? But I thought it would be nice to create a, you know, I didn't want it all to be, you know, dull and like doom and gloom and sad. And I think that perhaps provides a moment of hope and of joy for Val.
Have you started working on a new novel?
I have, yes. So I'm about halfway through a new novel, which is, I think now I've got a publisher, you know, you lose a bit of freedom, and I wanted to, and I have to make it, you know, so that it, you know, marries up with this one a little bit, or is it of similar tone and theme. So the one I'm working on is, again, it's an older protagonist. They're both in their 50s. So it's set in Liverpool this time, in the north of England, in the 1980s and the present. So again, there's going to be a dual timeline like there is with this one. And it's about a couple who fell in love when they were 17. And they had a big story, you know, something huge happened to them. But ultimately, they fell in love, and they've never forgotten each other. You know, they've just kind of, you know, carried a torch for one another all these years. But they went their separate ways when they were 18. They were kind of forced to. So in the present, they meet up in their mid-50s. He is actually, just to come back to the kind of, I think I've got a bit of an obsession with icons from the 20th century, because he's a Elvis impersonator. So he dresses up as Elvis. So there's a bit of a common thing there. So he's an Elvis impersonator. She goes to see him at one of his gigs, and she goes backstage afterwards. And, you know, she's in the audience, first of all, and just goes, "Oh my God, you know, it's him," you know. So, and so I suppose, but they both obviously got their stories and their own baggage and stuff. So, so it's a story of love lost and refound. Mm. Yeah.
I think we're getting close to the end, maybe. Maybe one last question. This is not related to your book, but.
Okay.
I don't know if everybody knows, but Elizabeth has a degree in French, and she taught French for quite a long time, and you are a self-described Francophile. Mm-hmm. So if you were to write a novel which took place in France, where would it be set, and in what period?
Oh, my goodness. That's a careful question. You know, it would have to be, you know, given where I am, I'll just linger here and just write one in Chambéry, I think. It's set in Chambéry. I do like cities. I love cities. I lived in Paris for a while. Cities fascinate me, and just things happen in cities, I think. So possibly there, but at the same time, just contradict myself, because I love nature writing as well. So yeah, I think my first novel was very much based on, you know, nature, and, you know, so I think
I don't think I'd be good at historical fiction. I think I like research, but I'd be too worried I'd get things wrong. And I kind of, I think I like writing about times where I either know now the present, or I quite like digging back into my own adolescence, really, you know, in the 70s and 80s. It's very kind of strong, you know, for me, because that's when I grew up. So I like going back there. So it would probably be in those decades, I think, 70s, 80s, present. I quite like that timeline. But where, I don't know. Anywhere in France. I love France. Just anywhere.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you all for coming today.
Yeah, thank you so much.